it'd have been better than to stand around and vacillate and never pull anything on, never do anything right because you change your mind all the time. So maybe they'll prove me wrong.
Whose idea was this to bring in this consultant?
Don't know. Sue Fry, I think.
Would it have been at that?
Oh, maybe it's higher than that. I don't know.
It would have been somewhere around that level.
Somewhere around there, yeah.
So obviously, someone thought that it needed.
Well, there's no question.
This is Dave Crippen. I'm out in a beautiful Orchard Lake with. This is Dave Crippen of the Edsel B. Ford Design History Center, and today is April 22nd, 1985. I'm sorry, 86. And I live in the past, you see. And we're talking today in beautiful West Bloomfield near Orchard Lake with Suzanne, S-U-Z-A-N-N-E, E, period, Vanderbilt, V-A-N-D-E-R-B-I-L-T. And this is a unique occasion for us because Suzanne was a long time, until her retirement, a long time staff designer for General Motors. And we are embarking on a series of interviews with female designers at the various automobile companies. And we are going to ask Ms. Vanderbilt to give us her career narrative at her own pace.
Just begin wherever you feel comfortable.
Okay. Well, I do have some papers in front of me here so that I can remind myself. and we could run through it, and if you, Dave, would like to stop at any point, that's fine with me, and ask any questions. Basically, I was born in Mount Vernon, New York, but I grew up in Larchmont, New York, not far from there. It's a suburb of New York City. And went to high school, Mamaroneck High School, the next town. And from there, I went to Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, New York, and graduated from there in 1955 with a degree of Bachelor of Industrial Design.
Tell us a bit about Pratt, could you, Susan? A lot of our interviewees are Pratt graduates. Mm-hmm. It seems to have been the incubator for a lot of industrial designers who later migrated to the automobile industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was not an automotive design school as Art Center is, or was, mm-hmm. and is. We could take some classes in automotive design, but I chose not to because I had no thought in my mind of ever coming A, to Detroit, and B, to design cars. I had a lot of background in basic design, and I thought that I would get more involved in form, and from that point I thought I would like to be involved in designing silver.
Silver?
Mm-hmm. And I
How'd
thought
that come about?
Well, I first of all, to back up a little bit, I I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I knew I didn't want to teach. I knew I didn't want to learn to type. And as a result, my mother said, "Oh my God, deliver us from crazy artists." And that was her opinion. So I did get far. I wanted to take some art classes as far back as high school. She said, "Well, that was all right. We'll try it once." But it turned out that music lessons were cheaper, and I doubt that. So, much against my will, I was taking piano lessons before I knew it. So, the art classes were out. She was a musician and taught piano, so that's how I fell into that. But I spent a lot of time in the basement with my dad because he was very handy at building things and making things. Mm-hmm. And I found that to be more to my liking. So, pounding nails into a block of wood at about age 6, I think, started it all. Because I knew I wanted to use my hands. I drew all the time. It wasn't something that I was forced to do. I did because I had to. So I have a feeling that I'm more artist than, quote, designer.
Mm-hmm.
And again, my mother could not understand this, you know. So from there, I've gotten ahead of myself, or in back of myself here, going back to high school. But I found the interesting thing was that I knew a long time ago that I wanted to do something in the arts. And in the high school, I wanted to take mechanical drawing. And they said that, and that's not that long ago, I'm not that old. And
They were aghast,
and they said, women don't do that. They don't take mechanical drawing. And I said, how come there's a woman teaching it?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I don't know, again, if somebody intervened at that point. And surprisingly, I wanted to take auto mechanics, not because I wanted to be dirty and messy and working around that kind of thing, but I thought it would be something that, again, was a three-dimensional, it was something I could get my hands into, and I think that's what I was looking for. And they said, no, I couldn't do that. So I fell back again into music, unfortunately, or fortunately. It gave me a great background, and I use that now, but then I was heartbroken.
These are the administrative people at Mamaroneck would not let you take a...
No, only boys. You see, those were the... It's strange, but we've really come quite a long way when it hasn't been that long ago. And so that was hard on me, because the art class was an extra, and it was lettering, and that's not what I wanted to do, but it was the only way I could get some feel for it. And when the art teacher said, A, you better get married, don't go into art. That did it again. And then she said, well, we'll give you a design project. And I thought, oh, good, because this is something, you know, you're looking forward to going to Pratt and design. And so I said, wonderful. And she said, well, would you design a cutting board for me? And so at that point, I thought, this is really hopeless. And that's the extent of my art background from the early days.
I called Mamaroneck a progressive high school a while ago.
Not very.
Not very.
And I guess maybe being interested in sports. You divert your attention wherever you have to if you bang your head against the wall enough times. As far as knowing about industrial design, as you well know, it was beginning at that time. It was in the early 50s that I even heard about what industrial design was, and it was a complete fluke. My father had a friend over for dinner, and I don't know how he got into it, but he said, Suzanne, what are you going to do with your life? And here you are, you know, just finishing high school. And I said, well, I'd like to do the following, and he understood that, and he came up with, well, why don't you take industrial design? I'd never heard of that. So I did some research on my own, because prior to that I thought medical art would be terrific, because I could combine, you know, the visual with the drawing and all of that. But then I realized television was coming along, and all kinds of things entered my mind, and decided that would not be perhaps as lasting as industrial design. Industrial design was new.
Mm-hmm.
So it just happened again that our next door neighbor, Rosalind Frank, and a graduate of Pratt, but in a different department, said, why don't you check with Mr. Boudreau, who was then head of the art school, and find out what you need to know about it.
B-O-U-D-R-E-A-U,
I believe. I think deceased. And I just put in my application for that, and it was more drawing than it was mental, and I was accepted. But then the fight there was to get into the industrial design department, because the first year is just general, and they say, well, if you don't want industrial design, or if you fail this, and what would be your second choice? And I said, I don't have one. So again, I managed to get through it.
We obviously were, obviously you had talent to be accepted and to get through the first year there.
Well, by today's standards, no. At those days, yes. If you consider making a drawing of your iron piece of furniture and interior of a room, I'm sure the requirements are quite different now. I don't know that I could pass it now if I had to.
Any well-known industrial designers on the faculty in those days?
Well, at that time it was Rowena and Alexander Costello. They were head of the industrial design department at that time. K-O-S-T-E-L-L-O-W. Rowena still lives in New York, and I think she does some teaching at Pratt and some work on her own, but I think she's probably not as active as she used to be. However, they, I would say, were instrumental in keeping me interested, because Alexander was an excellent teacher, although I do I do recall some of those classes where we would put our sketches on the wall. This was after I was accepted into industrial design.
Right.
And the wall was covered with what we thought, you know, wonderful sketches. Wonderful. Now, this is our first year industrial design. And he was teaching how to put something down in scale, how to shade something with a Conti crayon, but do it very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And he came in and out of all of these sketches, which we had to put up with matte tacks in a certain way, and of course we didn't know why, but later found out it was because he would rip everything off the wall and walk on it if he didn't like it. And he said, you know, you, in his accent, and I won't try to mimic that, he said, you students fall in love with your work, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until much later that I realized the reason for that is when you get out and you are competing with Art Center and Illinois Institute and all the other schools, you better be ready for it, because so many times you are trying to compete with people who are far better than you are in certain areas. Pratt at that time was not well known for slick renderings, but we had ideas and we had marvelous, I think, background in sketch technique.
That's unusual.
That's just one area. I do believe in our class of 55,
mm-hmm.
there are a number of the, and those that, you know, those years, there are a number of people who have done extremely well, and I'm sure you will find them as you go through this. And
well,
now I'm talking about industrial design,
right,
maybe not necessarily auto, but the thing that convinced me to come here was that A, I didn't have a job, and Rowena Costolos did talk to about four of us, four women, and she really convinced us. She said, why get caught up in a little town in Massachusetts polishing someone else's silverware and their design for many years until you were able to get onto the to the design end of something. I guess it took many years as an apprentice in order to do this. And it, from my point of view, I thought, well, all right, I'll just take the interview. And I had nothing in my portfolio that would pertain to automotive at all, except a few toys, which had wheels on them. And that was it.
What had been your major at Pratt?
Well, industrial design includes a variety of subjects, as you know. So we had to, we should be able to design just about anything.
Really?
Yes.
After
it's
the
just
four-year
career. Yes. Except that we would choose an area, maybe furniture,
mm-hmm.
maybe it was product design,
mm-hmm.
not advertising, that was a separate curriculum,
mm-hmm.
but any number of areas. Now I think it may be different, but in those days, if automotive design had been offered at Pratt, I probably would have looked into it, but not made it my major.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't. I wanted to combine mechanics somehow with a form, but that was not my, that was not available to me. So actually, I had to learn on the job. I remember Mr. Christensen and Dave Wheeler interviewed us at Pratt, and I did whip together a portfolio, and they came out and said, well, we will offer you this amount of money, and you can start July the 5th, and on and on, and it was
wait
so
a minute,
simple.
You're a little ahead of me here. Who were they connected with?
General Motors.
Oh, I see. I was going to ask you about that.
Tom Christensen was, at that time, I believe, in personnel.
Uh-huh.
And
Dave Wheeler?
Dave Wheeler, I don't know that, maybe he was a designer that they felt would have some feel for, you know, the industrial design department.
That's
yeah, but it'll click on.
They
just have various people who they send out. And subsequently, I found out it was people who were could talk to these to the students and had some rapport with them. They weren't too old and they weren't too young, and yet they represented the biggest at that time, the biggest corporation in the country. In the
this is an institute that Pratt, which majored in industrial, I mean, which was a major industrial design learning center, but did not have an automobile design orientation.
No, it did not. Not until later.
And yet. In 55, yeah. And yet GM and presumably other automobile companies were interested in some of their top graduates.
That's right. And I think it might have been because of the ideas that we had. I mean, you can use that anywhere. They did have a few classes, but it wasn't a major thing. You could take it as a separate, you know, if you wanted to, but I didn't see myself in that at all. So I wasn't railroaded, but I had a big show. And since there were other women who were willing to make that change and drive out here in an old car and set up housekeeping and so on, I decided, well, I'll try it. But I think if I had had to come alone, I would not have done it.
So Christensen and Dave Wheeler induced you to, did he look at your portfolio
yes.
at that time?
Oh, yes.
And he said, come on out, we have something for you, or we might have something.
Well, they said we would get back with you, and they wrote a very nice letter uh-huh. using he a lot, which you'll see in that. And in other words, we are offering you X amount of dollars a month, which sounded like a million to me.
Must have, yeah.
And the only problem was getting here rather quickly after graduation. There was no time to uh-huh. stop, and within a few months we were on overtime, and I got a good taste of what it was like to work uh-huh. for a big corporation.
Well, tell me, who came with you?
Well, the first group was Jan Krebs at that time, now Jan Krebs Lapine.
K-R-E-W-E-N.
Yes. And then Ruth Glennie, G-L-E-N-N-I-E, Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
And we drove out in about a 39. I don't know what it was. It must have been I don't know if it was a Studebaker or a Dodge. It was so funny because she had put new shock absorbers on the rear. And little did we know that that was in, you know, to have the rear end high and
right.
the nose to the
yes.
ground.
Right.
But it was very uncomfortable riding. And I can't, I wish I could remember the name. I'll think of the car's name,
yeah.
but. So we arrived July 5th, one of the hottest days of the year, came down Cass Avenue, and, you know, your feet stuck to the pavement.
Right.
And we had to stop and get our directions, so we stopped and had, I guess we went into a drugstore, and in those days you could buy sodas and
yes.
pop and stuff like that. And from the east, you know, I was completely surprised at when I said, oh, I gotta have some ginger ale. My throat is parched, and I got burners, and I'd never experienced such a fiery throat in my life.
Incredible.
And ever since then, I keep trying to get used to it, but I never have. That has nothing to do with automobiles. But anyway, we stayed at the Priscilla Inn, the three of us.
Where's that?
Cass Avenue, and I don't know, and I hope I never have to go back.
P-R-I-S.
P-R-I-S-C-I-L-L-A. I believe it's still there. It's across from the Masonic Temple.
Really?
And that was the only good part, is that we got to see an awful lot of wonderful things, music.
By registering there, that was your home?
For a while. The tech center got us here by saying we will be, or the GM really enticed us to come because they said we would be moving to a tech center, beautiful place, you know,
yes.
out in the country, right. Et cetera.
Where did they put you initially? On the boulevard?
Yeah, we were at the GM building.
Which
is down on, can't even remember anymore. The GM building.
Grand Boulevard.
Grand Boulevard,
yeah.
That's right.
Where were you, what department were you in there?
They did set us up in the interior design department right away.
Uh-huh.
And subsequently Dagmar Arnold came out, but she came under her own steam and was in another
mm-hmm.
another area. She was in the industrial design area
mm-hmm.
and worked on kitchens.
Came out from Pratt?
Yes, she
mm-hmm.
did.
Mm-hmm.
She is now working at IBM,
uh-huh.
but has made many stops along the way. So, anyway.
Were you something of an exotic site for male designers?
Well, we took a lot of ribbing, of course, and...
What sort of reaction did you get?
Well, I think there probably was somewhat of a feeling of, oh, well, this won't last.
Really?
Yeah.
They'll get discouraged and leave.
Yeah,
but, you know,
and...
they won't work out.
They, you know, we were young, and I was terribly skinny and not too happy about the whole living situation, which made work a little more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But I think... The one thing that I didn't have was the technique of finished polished renderings that the Art Center people had. So I made all my sketches in watercolor, and that, I guess, got most people quite hysterical because one day one of the bosses came in and said, well, maybe you've got something here. Let's see what we can do with it. And they threatened to send that watercolor sketch down to the shop to see if they could build it.
Really?
And my heart sunk. I don't know whatever happened to it. I think they kept it for, you know, posterity maybe. I never saw it again. But the ideas were there, and that's what was important. But I'll tell you, you learn very, very fast.
I'll bet you.
And it wasn't more than a few months, and we could do just as well as some of the men, I must say. And we started out on quarter scales, which they don't do now. They have people who do that for you.
Uh-huh.
So we really learned from ground one how to put the car together.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant, as an interior, designing the seats and the doors on a quarter scale. The instrument panel at that time was not part of our area, but eventually we did get to work in it. But those were the days when I think very much, many times we've had a misconception about interior designers, meaning you just select fabrics and sew things together,
mm-hmm.
just as interior, quote, decorators do.
Right.
But there's a lot more to it than that. And that's what we tried to tell the press over and over again. We weren't there just to decorate. Unfortunately, the projects that were publicized were decorating. We did not have a chance to redesign an instrument panel. We just suggested color. The trim design would change, new fabrics and leathers, and perhaps some innovations, and new carpeting, which they couldn't afford to do in production.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is... that went on for a number of years until they realized that there was more to it than that, and we just asked for more work and asked for more specific things.
Mm-hmm.
And that, after a few of the show cars that we did, I recall being called in to do some of the government cars when we used to build cars for the Army and the Navy. But again, it was strictly color and trim.
So you found yourself up against what has now become a cliche, that lady designers could only handle interior fabric and color.
That's right.
Designs.
That's right.
You said you did work on the dash.
Well, we did later on. I think it was very, very late into my career there that I actually did.
The hardware.
Research, and when I was in the research studios, they were more interested in the total car rather than just the inside and the outside. We talked about the total, and I enjoyed working there very much. But that was my first taste of instrument panel work.
What studio were you in the very first stage?
Well,
you mentioned your Chevrolet as your first
assignment. Yeah, that was really the first assignment, and that's when we were down at the General Motors, down in Detroit at the GM building. And really, it was an orientation time. Very quickly, they would run through the present proposals,
mm-hmm.
and then they'd get a reaction from us. And I didn't like anything, of course. And then we would go from there to what they were working on. It was always 2 years ahead. So we had 3-4 years to look at.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the boss, my boss, I can't remember his name. Well, the main executive that time was Henry Love.
L-A-U-V-E.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And in fact, I think his son is running for an office at the governor right now. It's interesting after all these years.
Yeah.
Anyway, I remember the boss's name, who was head of Chevrolet at the time, and it was Ken, and I don't remember his last name. But he was testing all the time just to see if I had any taste at all. And so maybe in a way it was good. We did do the quarter scales, which meant we'd have an idea and we'd put it down in very hard lines,
mm-hmm.
and also collect fabrics that would work well with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we could see it put together. That was also very good. And the instrument panel in those days, all of the clay models were in one room. All the interior design departments were in one room, whereas now they have separate studios and they're locked.
Mm-hmm.
No problem then going from one to another, although they didn't like it. But that was really all aspects. We did full-size drawings of seats and doors and all the parts, as I recall, except the instrument panel.
Mm-hmm. And you were doing, you would say 3/8, were you doing the actual models?
No, quarter scale.
I mean quarter scale.
No, this was strictly on paper.
Yeah.
Hard lines.
And they would be sent to the people who did the models.
Or to the people that would build them. They build seats and doors, believe it or not, as prototypes from those drawings, so
mm-hmm.
they had to be quite accurate.
Yeah.
And then eventually Fisher Body gets those and they make another prototype, and that's the way it goes. But I think the idea of moving from, as I did, from one area to another was probably within a corporation like that gave me a tremendous background. Because if you go to an industrial design firm and you just do one thing day in and day out, it gets very, very boring. And I like to move and learn new things. So then I moved from, as you can see here, from in 50, so it's 55 to 56, I was in Chevrolet Interiors. Then I went to Cadillac, and
why was that? What happened there?
Well, it's just a natural attrition. It's sort of, as in most of those studios, they like to keep people moving in the production studios.
Right.
And so you're never there for, in one area, too long. You may eventually come back to that, but you don't stay there long.
They want to stagnate at the beginning.
No. So then, at that time, my boss in Cadillac had an automobile accident.
Who was that?
Robert Shulk, S-C-H-E-E-L-K, I believe.
Bob Shulk, yeah.
Bob Shulk. And I was the only person in there that had had a few more years of background, and so I had to assume the assistant. Normally there would be a chief designer in those days, and that was it, and all the drones. But in order to have somebody answer the phones and answer a question, they had to assume an assistant chief designer. So at a very young age, I got a good taste of what it was like.
That's marvelous.
Yes, it was exciting, but you know, you're doing 100% plus time.
Right.
And so when he came back, then I could relax again. But it was wonderful because I could meet the managers, the general managers, and I'll think of those names. Bob Ahrens, I think, was the general manager. A-H-R-E-N-S, Ahrens.
General manager of Cadillac in those days.
Yeah, and then subsequently it was Mr. Roach.
Jim Roach, R-O-S-C-H-E.
And so when you're selling something, to meet these men at that age, it was, you know, you're nervous, but...
That was a period of about 6 months, wasn't it?
Yes. It was a short time. Well, Shulk, a year anyway.
Shulk did recover though and come back.
Oh yes, it was just a few months, but it was a wonderful experience for me. And then I think I was the one who said, okay, enough of this production work. I'd like to see what it's like in research studio. So I found my way down there.
That was their advanced studio of the day.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And Bob McLean was head of it.
He spelled his last name.
I think it's M-C-L-E-A-N. I think he died recently. But Stefan Habsburg was his assistant and in charge of that studio. H-A-B-S-B-U-R-G, of the Habsburg. I think that's correct. I have to look that up.
Right.
Now, if I'm giving you too much, just tell me. And I just feel that they had meetings where they would brainstorm and think tank almost.
Yes.
And that was exciting for me because after you're in production for a while, it becomes monotonous. So not that it isn't busy, it's the same over and over again. So I came in the midst of the finishing of the Firebird 3. And as I told you before, they were hesitant to give me much to do except an armrest and a little doorknob or something. So I felt I had some part in the Firebird 3, but that was pretty well completed by the time I got there.
That was one of their theme cars.
Yes.
Concept cars.
Yes, that's right. And I'm trying to think.
Could we stop for a moment?
Sure.
Let me ask you, if I may, Suzanne, at this early stage in your career, how did you feel about automotive design? Was it an exciting prospect? Obviously it was.
Yes.
But were you discouraged about the possible lack of advancement in terms of salary grade and responsibility?
Well...
That was available to women designers in those days?
Well, I didn't even ask the question, is there anything...
Yeah.
I mean, is there an area where I could excel as far as going up the ladder, if that's
right.
what you mean,
yeah.
from senior designer to junior designer, or junior designer rather to senior designer, etc. I didn't ask that question because I just wanted to be a good designer, and that may sound kind of silly right now. Mm-hmm. But that's all I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed and loved what I was doing after I got into it. I had only planned to stay a year or two, and I ended up there 23 years, so mm-hmm. obviously I enjoyed it, mm-hmm. or I would not have stayed. But I was never asked that question as they do now, or even then, of the men, what do you want to be? And if you say vice president, that's wonderful. I didn't think I'd ever even have the opportunity. Mm-hmm. That's not the way it worked then. So I just realized that after being there a number of years, and my salary was not on a level with some of the men, mm-hmm. I thought, well, in order to do that, I'm going to have to be a senior designer, an assistant designer, and or a chief designer. Mm-hmm. And to tell you the truth, I never really needed or wanted that. Mm-hmm. But in order to survive the cost of living changes and mm-hmm. have a place of my own, I accepted it. And then after each acceptance, I enjoyed what I was doing mm-hmm. more and more. But we were never, unfortunately, trained for that. Yeah. No, we were not trained for management positions. We learned that on the way up.
Interesting that you were designated assistant chief designer of the Cadillac studio. I think that's quite a... I was about to say that was quite a coup for a young, forgive me, female designer at that time.
That's true. Yeah. That's true, but what did I know?
Good for you.
And I think that probably without realizing it, I was very competitive, and again, without realizing it, very aggressive.
And you obviously had talent.
Well, I didn't know what it meant to have talent. Mm-hmm. And if you could put it down on paper was one thing. If you could sell it, it was another. And I thought that was terrific. If what I wanted it to look like or be for the car, and be able to sell that to the general managers, and they would agree, I had some satisfaction. I really got a great deal of satisfaction out of that, and I guess that's what makes it go around, isn't it?
Sure is. So you're now in late 58, and you're having a marvelous time in the what was the General Motors Advanced Studio at the time. You were about to tell us about some of the techniques of brainstorming and mm-hmm. and how you came up with advanced designs in those days.
Well, it was always a group
effort.
Mm-hmm. not anything that would bring laurels to one person, and mm-hmm. I thought that was the best way to operate. I still believe that. Mm-hmm. There may be one design, and people will talk about that forever, that there is one person who comes up with it and then 18 people put it together. Mm-hmm. But I do think we must open our discussions for design to many people and from many areas. And that's what we were doing. We had interior designers, exterior designers, human factors personnel, a lot of different background, engineers, draftsmen, and people who knew about materials. We had a tremendous number of talented people. And for me, it was just absolutely exciting. I really was, and thoroughly enjoyed it because we could come up with an idea, and in those days, if within limits, if I could order 18 splines of wood that might be 2 inches by an eighth, you know how floppy they can be. I just could use masking tape and tape these together into a form that was something you could sit in without the union coming down on us with, uh-oh, she's doing it again. So we would have them build a major structure like a center spline, maybe a 4x4.
Explain what a spline is.
Well, it's just a flexible SPL.
INE.
It's just a flexible piece of wood, like you call it slatting now mm-hmm. for a house. And usually maybe an eighth inch by an inch and a half wide. And at that length, at 18 feet or whatever it might be, it becomes very floppy. Mm-hmm. And you just tape these things, or without nails, you couldn't pick up a hander, you see.
Right, yeah.
And we did an awful lot of taping and a little bit of gluing here and there to get a feel for a vehicle. And at that time, we were working on Autoline, which subsequently became a research a report that Bob McLean gave to the Engineering Society in Detroit, and I would have those dates some other place as we go along, I'll find them. But that was the first exciting total car concept that we had, where we had designed a, or thought of, a linear electric motor, and don't ask me how that works. Take my word for it, they had it. And that was Bob McLean's input into this, and we thought that we needed a vehicle and that would be on a system with wheels up against a trough with the linear electric motor. And as you come off or on the system, the wheels are down and you drive it just like you would a car today. But the exciting thing then was, and I still have a thorn in my side because of it. Not too long ago, not more than a few weeks ago, I noticed in the newspaper not only Ford but General Motors had described a system that they're still working on but could be available soon, where you know where your car is on the road with a screen. And I could show you drawings that I made, and this is not patting myself on the back, I just find it very amusing, where I had this cylinder set up in front of what would have been the driver's situation, not necessarily a steering wheel, whereby you buy in those days a triptych from your AAA, if I could use the that word. And I pictured it on a scroll, but that it would be magnified in certain situations on this system. So you knew where you were all the time. You knew where the vehicle was. You would know if you had to get off the system for whatever reason, what the situation was in traffic and that kind of thing. And on and on and on. But you know, they couldn't build it then because we didn't know how. We didn't have the electronics we do now.
The technology.
I find that to be true right down the line, because especially in research. We could propose it, but we couldn't build it. And now when I see it, you know, the hackles go up and say, darn it, we should have really hung in there. And the other one, which is more recent, and you will remember this, is the inflatable seat back support.
Yes.
I have a patent on that.
Do you really?
With General Motors.
Wow.
And the only reason I'm telling you that is for this particular
yes.
situation that we're going through now. And I don't talk about it, but when I proposed that, there was very little interest.
What year was that?
Sometime
in 58?
Well, I could... probably later than that. I presented that at 1964 at the orthopedic surgeons meeting, but
that's right. This your whole seating study was presented by request at the National Meeting of the Orthopedic Surgeons, Chicago, Illinois, in 1964.
That's right.
The topic was a study in vehicle mm-hmm. seating.
That's right. But
was this quite revolutionary?
Oh yes, because we made that so that it would fit the current, at that time, springs and foam and that kind of thing situation,
right.
stuffing in the
mm-hmm.
seat.
Yes.
And today they don't use that.
Right.
But it would have been easy to do. And it was tested at the proving grounds.
Really?
But we're right back to money again.
The bottom line.
But the funny part of it was, a few months ago, one of the chief designers stopped over with a new car, visited for a little while. And I said, what's that switch up on the seat cushion there? You know, they build up the size of the seat. Oh, he says, let me tell you about that. And he told me it was part of this lumbar support, inflatable lumbar. And I said, isn't that interesting? Well, where do you suppose that came from? He says, well, I don't know, but we've been working on it. I said, guess who has the patent? And of course, his face was red. I'm sure they've made modifications. But again, they weren't ready for this. The only problem with this is that it took me a number of years to develop this with the help of Peter Kyropoulos, Kyropoulos, who was then technical director of GM design staff. And we were getting more and more involved in human factors and safety at that time. And we felt if we could enhance the system in any way that we could, this would be one way, is to make people more comfortable. We found people taking old slippers and rags and pillows and putting at the lumbar spine.
Mm-hmm.
But the mistake that they made when they took it out to the proving grounds to test this was they felt they had to feel it in order to have it work, and that's not the case. With all the research we made, you don't need more than about a quarter of an inch or less of dimension mm-hmm. to change the attitude of this lumbar support.
Uh-huh.
And you could have it in the thoracic, the lumbar, or the sacral. We had three of these things.
Three positions.
Oh, yes, mm-hmm. But...
What was the basic principle?
Well, it was, if you mean the construction of it, it was just three horizontal tubes of rubber.
Mm-hmm.
Each could be inflated separately or together with what amounted to be a window switch at that time, which activated a little motor that pumped air.
Okay.
But you could also do it the simple way and use a blood pressure mechanism, you know, like they just use a bulb. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that was simple because you could pump it up, feel it, and then let it out, let the air out. And we had three of those, and I have photographs, and I have the patents, and I just think to myself, it really is fun. I got a dollar for my efforts, though.
So. That was your only royalty?
Oh, yes.
The company has taken all royalties.
Well, they didn't because they didn't produce it. And
oh, they didn't?
No. It went outside, yes. And I think they might have let the medical field have it, because we did work with an orthopedic surgeon who wanted to give it to some of his patients. Now, this is some of the... these things are not meant to be a criticism of General Motors or any corporation.
It would happen anywhere.
It would happen anywhere, but it was just the fact I felt, well, maybe it's because it's a woman that has thought of this, and we have a lot of men here who are doing the same thing, research, but haven't come up with that.
What about Kyropoulos? Was he supportive?
Oh, he was supportive. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we had to go on the bit, as far as the test went, it was not approved. So that was the end
of that. What happened at the test at the proving grounds? I have a research.
It was out at the Milford Proving Ground. I have a research report on that.
Do you?
Yeah, I can show it to you. I don't know it by heart, but...
But basically what happened?
Well, they didn't feel that it was comfortable. But you see, you don't hand it to someone else who has not designed it, who may... You see, everybody is a different dimension, too, sitting dimension. When you sit down, if you're very heavy, you don't displace the seat the same as if you're very thin. It's the same process of...
Sure.
Women with heels, that per square inch poundage on one little quarter inch heel is much greater than if you wore a flat, wide shoe. So it's the same principle. You don't deflect the seat as much.
Did you have any orthopedic support? People in the orthopedic field?
Yes. I consult. Oh, yes. Dr. Esslinger, who at that time was an orthopedic surgeon, was our consultant, paid and consultant. Esslinger. I don't believe he practices here anymore, but he was at Beaumont at the time, and he's the one that gave us the support and was interested, and I learned probably as much about the vertebral column and all its related parts as I could. And I have a book that's a complete work on that, so other people could carry on from that. We knew that seat cushions, for example, the ischial tuberosities are the two points under your bottom that
What's
are...
the first word?
It's I-S-C-H-I-A-L. So you're going to...
Tuberosities?
Tuberosities.
Mm-hmm.
These are things that become sore if you ride a bicycle on a hard seat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
Well, in order to take some of the pressure off of that, I learned that if you were to cut... let's say, varying dimensions or a hole where those two areas would most likely be for most people, you could take the pressure off.
Mm.
Because the only reason we squirm and move around is because we're uncomfortable. Something really is hurting. And short of sitting in a bowl full of jelly or jello, okay, you know what I'm saying. And in the research studio, we designed other things where you could have one fiberglass shape all in one piece and then have little sections that would inflate and deflate depending on the person themselves. So you'd always have a seat that would accommodate everyone, so you don't have to blow these things up. I mean, all of these things had to be keyed to either research or to production. And I could go on for days about the things that I feel would still be an advantage today, short of growing. And I'm not kidding, growing a seat. We even talked about if you went to a dealer, for example, and you said, I'm 5 feet five and I weigh so much and I'm so on, that sooner or later he would be able to order you a specific seat. But with your situation of four different drivers, what are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's where all of these changes would occur,
right.
Program changes. And I'm sure they could do it now, but it's very expensive.
But in those days, the odd that the proving grounds would have been the place where the final test results were decided. It must have been very frustrating for you.
Oh yes, but I just moved on to another area. Mm-hmm. I kept trying.
Well, now, let's try and follow this up.
It was dead.
It was dead.
Yes.
And for money and for other complicated reasons,
right,
in terms of multiple drivers and so forth. But
oh no, we could have solved multiple drivers. It just was not comfortable for whomever tested it.
Did you ever find out who that was?
I could probably find that. Yes, but I would not want to put him on the spot.
Was he ahead of the testing program out there?
He was probably not ahead. He was probably a hired driver that was part of the General Motors team. And I was surprised that they didn't invite me to go out and talk to them about it and discuss it and try to make them understand that this was a subjective but objective results should be expected. And I'm sure they pumped it up too hard. And naturally, if you get something too hard, it's going to hurt. And they didn't read my instructions, that's for sure.
This was almost 30 years ago. It's understandable that there is not the sensitivity to human factors or ergonomics that you have today, but it seems incredible even today that they would entrust it to someone who said, I'm uncomfortable.
Well, I think this comes from the top. I think maybe they, in a way, felt that unless a production studio executive pushed it, they weren't going to spend any more research dollars on it. I think it comes down to money each time.
It does.
In
yeah.
production. Mm-hmm.
Was your then head of the studio, who was that? Head of the advanced studio?
Well, we reported, and the words would come yes and no from Steve McDaniel.
Who was?
Then chief of interior design, okay. Totally interior design.
Were you able to interest him in this at all? Was he sympathetic?
I don't believe so, but poor man, he died recently. You know.
Really?
Yes. And I would hate to make judgments on what his thinking was, but it was just flat no. So
that was it. It was dead.
Well, you don't question it. In those days, you don't question authority.
Yeah.
You see, and again, a woman respecting authority, and then again, I hate to keep saying those days. It sounds like really
almost 30
archaic.
Years ago. Yeah.
I think today a woman would say, "Now, just a minute. I have proof, or let me further test this, or give me my own time, or whatever it would take to do it." And
did
besides,
that occur to you then?
No,
that?
Oh, never.
Just didn't know.
No, because it sounded like the authorities had put a stamp on it and said no.
Yeah.
And I don't know who resurrected it, and I don't know how it got back into automotive. And I don't know what form it is. I don't take the seats apart anymore. I don't look at it. All I know is that somebody's using it and they're making some money on it. And I don't know whether they had to pay to get it back or if they ever let it out. And I really don't care. The main thing is that if people can be more comfortable in driving situations, then I feel happy about it. And if, in fact, we ever get this, I'll call it the triptych, because that's what it was then, wonderful, but I just laugh inside a little bit that until we went to the moon, I guess we didn't know how to do these things. So it was discouraging in some areas in research because we didn't know how to put them into production, whereas in production you did what we knew how to do, and at least in 2 years you saw it on the road.
Mm-hmm.
So that was satisfying.
You obviously were something of a visionary in these days.
Well, I think throughout my whole life, I have always thought maybe ahead, and that's not being egotistical, maybe it is, but I will not stand for today. I always try to think about tomorrow and what we have to do. In my present situation, I have to live each day by day, but I'm always thinking a few years down the road. You know, what will I be doing?
The triptych that you described earlier, was that a visual? Did you say a visual map reading device?
Oh yes, and you could plug it in.
Cathode ray tube. And
we didn't have anything to go on.
It was just the principle. The
principle of it.
Yeah.
You know, I have the drawings. I still have the drawings somewhere.
Gosh.
And
did you have a patent on that?
No, in research studio we didn't do that.
Oh, you didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
production areas we did get patents on things, but after a while I caught on to that game too. And it would seem that the more patents you could come up with, which meant simply calling one of their patent attorneys and say, I think I've got an idea, That's how people made little bonuses. But I decided once I found that out, that wasn't important. So I didn't fight for that, or everything could be patentable, you know, every little thing.
But it was the unwritten law in the the band studio that you did not patent ideas that came up in brainstorming.
Oh, no, the research studio is the brainstorming. The advanced studio was directed primarily to interior design studio, and that's where we got into the safety and these lateral supports. I also worked on a collapsible switch with Packard Electric, and have a patent on that too. And that might have been used, I don't recall. You know, after you've done it, go on to the next thing.
You call it a safety switch here. How did that work?
Well, it was taking the, we could not change the design per se. Everything had to happen behind the instrument panel.
Uh-huh.
So it was simply a breakaway. As you hit it, it broke a little ring and went on through to the instrument panel, because we found that if you were strapped in at that time with lap belt only, on a front impact, you would slide forward and your knees would hit something. Then you would pivot up and your head would hit something. And so in those days, we tried to take care of things that were in the way. So the first thing I attacked, naturally, would be something that you hit first. And I don't even recall whether we ever got into that. But it would act like a lighter. You know, when you press the lighter in, it goes out of the way.
Yeah.
Well, it would
recess.
Yes, but it would never pop out again. This thing would stay in there jammed. But it could be repaired, because they didn't want to lose maybe some of that. And
what did it affect, the switch itself?
Could be any knob on the instrument panel. Could have been lights, or could have
been extruding material.
Life-threatening. Well, you try to get away from that. You know, the knobs had to be checked out for the various things, and I did work on a lot of that. We had occasion to go to New York and work with a group who designed dummies. And at that time, they had not thought of Oscar and skin. We had to design with Mr. Gadd at the research studios, or the research development area at GM, a skin that you could put on top of these dummies so that we could better check lacerations and skin problems, you know, from accidents. So there was a lot of work going on then. It's just that it was hard to get it going. I hope we don't get sued.
Well, this is very interesting that you're working on safety and human factors fairly early, I guess.
61.
Yeah. And
but I was directed to do this too. You know, this was not, it wasn't something that I thought of to do. But it ties in with making controls easier to reach. That's all part of it.
Yeah.
Because as the cars were coming down in size and getting smaller even then, we had to make sure we could get people in and out, and we weren't bumping heads, and we could still reach controls and that kind of thing. I found that fascinating. But as you can see, I moved on.
This was under the general direction of Dr. Peter Cryopoulos.
And that I was doing at the same time I was doing production work for Steve McDaniel. I always seemed to get a little extra work, but that was all right.
What do you mean by mutual development? What was that? What aspect of that was a part of your training? This is under your work experience. 1961.
Oh, well, that's with the research department. Meaning, well, it wasn't within design staff. This is the research group that was across the lake.
Uh-huh.
So we worked with them as well. Yeah, it was fascinating.
In terms of
testing
of the human environment.
Yes, testing. And then we eventually, Cryopoulos did set up a human factors and safety department, and I believe Ron Rowe had a lot to do with that, and Stefan Habsburg again, and the names don't come to me, but I'm sure that we can find those. And so then we had a full-fledged human factors group going.
That's very exciting to think back at this fairly early date. There was concerted research effort. You always have trouble getting the bureaucracy to accept it. Came up with something exciting in terms of
saving someone's life?
Oh, well, we'd have to be very careful about saying that. We, I think from day one, we had to consider that. We didn't know until we directed our attention to the proving ground facilities, which could tell us what happens during impact mm-hmm. with dummies. Mm-hmm. And we even introduced the child dummy at the time, and what happens in front end, side impact, and so on. Mm-hmm. It was very hard at the time to determine what really happened unless you went, as I did, to boneyards, as we call them, mm-hmm. and looked at the crashed cars, which is not very pleasant. But I wanted to know, and I had to try to do that before lunch, and that was okay. Not my favorite thing, but yes.
Was Dr. Helke from Ann Arbor into this by this time?
I don't remember the name.
He has done a lot of work with crashes mm-hmm. and medicine, the type of referrals to automobile companies for just what happens in a certain type of crash.
That's right. Yeah. Well, we studied all of the films, and I was supposed to bring back any of that information and try to encourage our people to design for that. And there was a big change occurring about that time. That doesn't mean that we purposely designed to hurt people. That was not the case. The thing that we wanted to stress is to prevent the accident before it happened. Better driving situation, testing, you know, having the kids go through better driver training situations, all of that. You can't tell somebody how to drive. You learn how to drive.
But you must admit that there was a certain reluctance on the part of management, all management, to come up with devices which reminded people that they could be hurt in the car. I think this was mm-hmm. largely the result mm-hmm. of the Public Relations Department, who felt
yes.
we should not emphasize that people can be hurt in the car.
That's right. That's exactly
so
true.
You must be working. You must have been working under rather heavy wraps in a sense, mm-hmm. and that you had to take it step by step in order to get it accepted.
Like everything else, that's true.
Well, that must be exciting for you.
Well, it was,
really trying
but
to help people survive.
Well, yes, but that I felt was probably should have been left to people who had, well, there weren't any people that had the experience. I was trying to get it, and I think it was more for, so that in future designs, you automatically think of that just as you do any other design input, whether it's human factors or safety or appearance. You know, we deal a lot in appearance. How does something look?
The safety.
But I wasn't in that a long time. I wasn't in that a long time.
The safety belt had come out probably in the mid-50s. Was it general standard equipment with the General Motors products by the early 60s?
Oh, I would think so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What did you do any research with the shoulder harness at that point?
Yes, they had many 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 proposals mm-hmm. and many many changes to what we now know as the shoulder harness. So many things had to be considered. You must have the support system from the floor,
mm-hmm. right.
From overhead, you know, roll bars went in.
Right.
It's a lot to support the G-forces that are incurred. And you still can't strap someone in so tight that they are uncomfortable. So all of these things, yes, had to be considered. At that point, I was not into any of the, I didn't do any of the design work on seat belts per se, but as a designer, we had to be aware of what was going on so that we could make our seat backs accommodate. You remember when seat backs were very low? That's a long time ago. In the early 50s, 40s, all seat backs were quite low. Then they added the height plus the headrest, and then adjustable headrests. And really, that's out of my area. That's an engineering situation,
yeah.
not something I had a lot to do with. But I think we're more and more conscious today of that.
But the fact that you had a human factors committee. And
mm-hmm.
you were involved in it,
mm-hmm.
and working under a scientist, Dr. Karayopoulos.
An engineer.
Mm-hmm. So obviously there was some great concern internally.
He was, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Did he have enough clout to be able to say to his executives above him that mm-hmm. this should be done?
I think he, yes. It's unfair of me to judge because I wasn't there to hear any of his comments to,
yeah.
you know, other executives, but I would call him somewhat of a loner.
Mm-hmm. So he was sort of outside the
bureaucracy. He worked with research staff and with proving grounds and with us, but you know, it's hard to tell a designer what to do, and it's hard for a designer to tell engineering what to do. There's always going to be a conflict there. We want to make it look as good as possible and work. And an engineer will say, yes, we want it to work too, but you've given us an impossibility here. We've got to go back and redesign, and all the time that that's going on, it's costing more and more and more money. And again, I shouldn't comment about that. That's something that they should discuss. But we did begin it. Yes. Mm-hmm.
But you did come up with, I'm fascinated by this, you did come up with, you and your associates and Dr. Karopoulos, come up with the early concern for ergonomics or ergometrics, mm-hmm. or the life of the passenger in the driver's compartment.
As far as I know, that was the beginning of it.
Mm-hmm. I think you were well ahead of others. Mm-hmm. Well, that must have been exciting, but you moved on and after a couple of years to what?
Well, in 61, within that same studio, I was made assistant chief designer. And I don't know that really meant a lot.
You the first, do you think?
I think so.
First female assistant chief designer?
Yes, as far as I know. And but again, it was a matter of not so much to satisfy the ego, but to get some more ideas going, because then you'd have just a little more of an edge, mm-hmm. and you could tell someone else maybe how you would like to have it run. But then, mm-hmm. as all things go, I felt I was locked in again. You know, I didn't want to do that all the time, mm-hmm. so I chose to request a return to school for a Master of Fine Arts, and that was in 1963 to 65. And I didn't want to leave the state because I still wanted to go back and work for General Motors, but I...
Where was that?
I went to Cranbrook.
I remember flipping. I was going to say, 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 I was going to say,